So we're in the middle, more or less in the middle, of a series of talks on a very important list in the teachings of the Buddha called the Seven Factors of Awakening. And as I say it's a list, I feel a little bit, seem a bit deflated. A list. It seems so impersonal, inhuman, a list. But another way of saying it is that there are seven qualities, capacities, some people call virtues, that can be developed, that are developed as people do practice, do mindfulness practice. And they're very helpful and important to know what these are and to recognize them and to support them and encourage them as we go along in practice. And they are presented sometimes as the counter to a whole different list, a whole different set of qualities, which are called the five hindrances. And in juxtaposition to each other, the five hindrances are those forces of the mind, those qualities of mind, which hinder or obscure the clarity of the mind, the ability of the mind to be present. And the seven factors of awakening are those qualities of mind which support our capacity to be present and open and clear in the present moment, to be awake. It's called seven factors of awakening. And in a sense, the five faculties are forces of being asleep, spiritually asleep, and the seven factors of awakening are forces of being awake. So to step back even further to talk about the background for these seven factors of awakening and the five hindrances. The early Buddhism, teaching of the Buddha, was, as far as I can tell, was not particularly interested in the question of what is human nature. As if there's some essential human nature that kind of characterizes who we are. We're essentially good or essentially evil or something, or the idea of Buddha nature, which appeared later in Buddhism, that we have this nature inside of us which is Buddha-like or is a Buddha, that kind of discussion wasn't present in the early tradition. But rather, what the early tradition was interested in was, instead of human nature, was human capacity. What is the human capacity? What's the human capability? What are we capable for of doing? And the idea of human capacity is very important for this tradition because human agency, what we can do, what we can take responsibility for in terms of ourselves is very important. The idea that what you do has consequence was taken very seriously by this early tradition. And sometimes when certain religious traditions talk about human nature, it lends itself sometimes to like if you say human nature is all good, some people just relax, which is good to relax. They, oh yeah, and then they're still buoyed and supported by a religious view. Oh, I'm great, I'm good. No, you know, end of story. I don't have to do anything. I just know that I'm saved or something. And the idea in the early tradition is that you don't want to just simply just in a sense accept the way you are. You want to take what you are and understand that who we are is also a capacity. And we want to be able to use that capacity in order to act on this insight that our actions have consequences, our behavior has consequences. So if you so if we constantly go around lying and stealing, then the continuity and the regularity of that kind of action has consequence. One consequence it has is maybe make a habit out of that kind of behavior. And so it becomes a lot easier for the mind to lie. But even more worse, chances are in order to lie and steal, there's a kind of contraction, a lack of sensitivity, a lack of empathy, a lack of understanding, lack of connection in many different fronts, many directions in that. And so as we continue this kind of activity, we build up a certain armor, or build up a certain closeness or numbness or something to what's going on. If we spend a lot of time with the five hindrances, for example, caught up in sensual desire, caught up in aversion, it has a consequence, and it kind of closes us down. It kind of sets up the forces inside of us that perpetuates ignorance, perpetuates being disconnected, perpetuates acting from places inside of us that maybe are more subconscious, unconscious, not well considered. And I think probably most of you, my guess, have had some experience in your life of acting out of desire, acting out of aversion, and later regretting having done that. That this was unfortunate. You wonder, well, how could I have done that? What was going on with me? I was kind of caught up in the moment in these forces. So these have consequence to these things. You know, our actions have consequence. It's a fundamental principle of Buddhism. And we can take some, we have some responsibility, we have some capacity in that, in the field of action to make a difference for the better. And so human capacity is one to move towards something better, but not just simply better in some generic way of better, to make us kind of generally happier or generally kind of less stressful. But the tradition actually points to a possibility of a radical change, radical transformation, which is defined by the word, often defined by the word awakening. And the word in Buddhism is awakening. It's translated as awakening is bodhi. And bodhi gives us the name for Buddhism and for Buddha. So to be awake, to be awakened. And to be awakened, to have these qualities of and awakening doesn't come just not a kind of some disembodied or disconnected kind of state, but it comes with some really nice qualities of mind, like qualities of heart. And these are called the seven factors of awakening. And so the first one is mindfulness. The second one is investigation. The third one, which is a topic for today, is energy. The fourth one is joy. And the fifth one is tranquility. The sixth one is samadhi, or concentration. And the seventh one is equanimity. And these are considered kind of like the crown jewels of Buddhism, or real treasures, these seven qualities. And so these are qualities that are found not externally in the great repository of Buddhist books, but rather are found inside of yourself. And they can be cultivated, the capacities we all have. So when we look at human capacity, human capability, then these are qualities that can be developed over time as we practice. And these get developed and get stronger until they get strong enough that they put us at the edge of this transformation that Buddhism focuses on, where we kind of take a leap into a very different orientation, very different kind of understanding of who we are and how we are in the world, that sometimes define the tradition as being unconditioned. So a stance, a position, a way of being in the world that's not dependent on the conditions of the world, but has discovered some way of being that's unconditioned, undependent, unsupported, independent in some very radical, deep way. And so what's beautiful about this is that as the movement towards this radical transformation is built on having these seven factors of awakening quite strong. So rather than it being some radical giving up of some, you know, of all good things, the movement towards freedom comes along with cultivating, developing these treasures, these wonderful qualities within us. So one of those qualities is energy. And in the sequence of the seven factors of awakening, energy follows investigation. Because one reason is that they say that as we begin engaging in our life through investigation, looking more carefully, being curious about what our life is like, what's going on here and now, that tends to bring more energy. We get more engaged because of the curiosity, the interest. What is this? What's going on here? So part of the one of the important qualities of Buddhist practice is interest. To be interested. What is going on here? What's present here? What's our experience here? And to have to heighten, to strengthen that interest. And as that interest gets stronger, in the wake of that, there comes greater energy, aroused energy. There are a lot of words in the teachings of the Buddha that are close synonyms to the word for energy. And it's quite amazing if you go back and read the ancient text, how many words how much the emphasis is on active engagement, endeavor, energy, diligence, vigilance, ardency. Isn't that a great word? To be ardent. So the Buddha emphasized the importance for people who practice mindfulness to be ardent. Sometimes Buddhists get the reputation of being kind of really calm. And, you know, everything's okay. You know, Buddhists, everything's okay for Buddhists. So, you know, just, oh, whatever's fine. Remember when I was a hippie hitching around communes in Oregon many, many years ago. I was quite young, naive, idealistic. And my girlfriend lost her flashlight someplace. And I said, oh, it doesn't matter, nothing matters. She got angry with me. So certainly it's important, it's helpful to be calm. It's one of the factors of awakening. Tranquility is one of the factors. But as a factor of awakening, it's listed after this quality of energy, or ardency. And I've seen this when I was in Japan, practicing Zen. Zen Buddhism there in the monasteries. I got admonished sometimes by the other monks, the older, more senior monks sometimes, because I wasn't engaging in some of the activity in the monastery, whatever it might be, working, cleaning, sweeping, different works we did. I didn't do it with a proper Zen no chikara. Chikara, is that how it's pronounced? Chikara, power, strength. I had to have a Zen chikara. And everything had to be done with Zen power, Zen strength. And you had to kind of do something. Your whole being, you have to really engage in it. Your whole being, everything had to be there, involved and engaged. And you couldn't just kind of like, you know, casually sweep the path, you know, like, you had to kind of put yourself into it and be engaged in energy. So energy. So for people who are already exhausted from working so hard, it can be quite discouraging to hear that Buddhism emphasizes energy, engagement, effort, ardency. I mean, gee, you know, I'm already so exhausted, and the reason I come to Buddhism is to get some rest. And now they're telling me that I have to kind of gear up. I mean, that's what the whole society is telling us all the time. Gear up, gear up, gear up. You can't get enough. You have to do, do, do. And I've heard these Buddhists who say, let's stop doing. Let's just be. You know, being. Finally, I can just be. I don't have to be anything. I just be. I don't have to be something for anybody. Isn't that great? So as an antidote to people who overdo and overbe, or over, you know, whatever, the teaching of just like, don't stop doing, just be. You don't have to be anything, you don't have to become anything, just kind of relax, is a wonderful medicine, a very radical, very powerful medicine. And so when I was went to Tassajara, the Zen monastery, the first time to be a monk there, Tassajara, if you don't know, has these wonderful hot baths. People come from all over the world to go to during the summer to be in it's like a resort in the summer and to use the hot baths and luxuriate. In the winter time, when it's an intense Zen monastery, the hot baths are still there, and the monks, it's in the schedule every day you get to go in the hot baths. There's a bath hour at 4 or 5 o'clock or so. So it's very good in the winter because it's cold. There was no heat when I was there except the hot baths. So you go there and get warm. When I first got there, I would luxuriate every day in this wonderful hot tubs. And then the course of the months, I found that I took shorter and shorter baths. I would shower up. You had to shower in the showers, clean up, and then go in the plunge. And as the time went along, my period in the plunge was shorter and shorter and shorter until it basically became just a quick dip. That was enough. I felt finished. Got a dip, got a little warm, and went on with my monastic life. And I noticed this, and I said, what's happening to me? I used to be able to luxuriate, enjoy it, and relax. And now, you know, am I getting more tense? Am I getting more ambitious, trying to do more things? You know, why am I not staying and enjoying the baths? I mean, this is a world-class resort. And so I kind of looked at it a little bit, and my conclusion was that the reason I luxuriated when I first got to the monastery was I needed to relax. And it was a compensation, it was the relief, it was the medicine. And as I lived my life in the monastery, the tensions and stresses of my life started falling away. And I didn't have them. I didn't build them up. I wasn't creating as much as I used to have. And so I didn't need to use the bath to relax. And therefore, I didn't need to linger in the hot bath. I just could do it and get up and go on and do my life. So, so there are certain teachings that people love to hear that are more medicine for particular states. But as the illness goes away, then perhaps we find it more appropriate and helpful and, you know, and something we want to do to be engaged, to make effort. Just like when I finished being, you know, had all the relaxation I needed in the hot tub, I got up and went about my life, did the things I had to do. You know, I was happy to do them. I didn't have to stay there and just rest and linger. So I think that having energy and engagement is a beautiful quality of life, and it can be done in ways that doesn't cause stress. And one of the ways it doesn't cause stress is when we engage with effort and we don't connect that effort to measuring ourselves and a self-identity, a self-concept or self-representation that we're trying to build up, enhance, protect, defend, do all the things that people often do that often are connected to the way we make effort, the way we engage in life. So as practice, as the mindfulness and investigation helps us to relax, all this extra stuff we kind of connect to effort, then the effort and the energy can be cleaner, simpler, more straightforward. And in being cleaner, it could also be more energetic, more engaged, more full. Here I am, present, engaged, ready to do. So that's good to be energized in a nice, balanced, relaxed way without... Then the question is, what do we do with this energy? The energy of the seven factors of awakening. What do we do with this effort? Now to kind of add to kind of the strength or the power of this quality, this idea of energy and what it entails, I can tell you the etymology of the word energy, the Pali word. It's virya. The word is virya. And vira, it comes from vira. Vira means hero. So it's not just energy. It has this connection to being heroic. So that's quite something. Gee, you know, Buddhism is supposed to be relaxed and being no one, going nowhere. And now I'm being told to be heroic? Give me a break. But I think there's something, I don't know, maybe we don't have to use the word heroic, but there's a great nobility, there's a greatness, it's a really wonderful thing that we're engaged in when we do this practice. This possibility of awakening, of freedom, is one of the great goals of life. Not only for our own sake, but it's really, I think, phenomenally helpful for the people around us to discover this, to have this. And a story I like to tell to make this point. In September of 2001, after 9/11, there was a couple from IMC who were going to go sit a 3-month retreat right afterwards. They're like a few days later, a week later, they're going to go off and sit a 3-month meditation retreat. And I made a point to go find them. And I said to them, you might feel like in the wake of 9/11, when the whole country is traumatized, this huge need, that to go off by yourself on a retreat for 3 months and shut, you know, not be connected to our society and what's going on is unacceptable, not appropriate. Somehow that's wrong. That you have to kind of maybe not go on retreat, stay and be connected or help with a cleanup or something. And I said, I want to reassure you that I think that it's a very powerful and significant response to 9/11 to go on a long retreat like this, because some human beings, we need someone in this world who engages in the process of getting down to the depths of their own hearts, their own minds, and uprooting the forces of greed, hate, and delusion, uprooting and awakening the forces of compassion, awakening the forces of peace, awakening the possibility of awakening. If we don't have some people who can show us that that's possible, then maybe there's very little hope in general. Then it's all just kind of rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic. So someone needs to do that deep work. And hopefully that deep work is very helpful for some of the important causes and issues that our whole society has to face. So the idea of the energy is really a noble one, a beautiful one. And so once we've kind of settled out the kind of the neurotic energy, the exhaustion we have, the trauma we have of trying to prove ourselves and be somebody, there can be this beautiful quality of engagement that can come up and be there. Sometimes we talk about effortless effort, when there's no self connected to the effort. It just kind of flows out of us in a beautiful way. But there's still effort. And because this early tradition focuses on the importance of human agency, that what we do can make a difference, effort is not just effort, whatever you want to do, but an emphasis on the effort in particular areas of life. So not just simply wholehearted effort in sweeping the path of the monastery, but particular kinds of, certainly you should be engaged and present for everything you do, but certain kinds of effort are more helpful and more efficacious than other kinds of effort. And the tradition then talks about four kinds of right effort, four kinds of right engagement. And these can be summarized in a very simple way. Avoid trouble. If you're in trouble, get out of trouble. Cultivate good skills and keep them up. Keep them going. I first heard this kind of summary of the four right efforts from someone who was a kayaker. And the person said, oh, this four efforts is just like what I learned in kayaking, which is stay out of trouble. Stay out of trouble. If you're in trouble, get out of trouble. Develop your skills, your capacity, and then keep them up, keep those skills up so you don't get, so you can do this kayaking well. So the way it's said in the tradition is a little more complicated. It says, abandon the unskillful, unhelpful states of mind. Prevent the arising of the unhealthy states of mind which are not present currently. And then cultivate the skillful and helpful qualities of mind, and then promote them once they're there. Nourish them. Those are called the four efforts. So with this comes some appreciation that we have some ability to tip the balance in our own mind and hearts. That when our hearts and minds are engaged in activity and forces and thoughts and motivations and states which are unskillful, unhelpful, unhealthy, it's possible to move away from them. It's possible to learn the skills, the capacity to let go of them, not pick them up, not act on them, not be under their influence. It's possible to kind of put them down. It's also possible to do a certain kind of inner cultivation so the tendency towards picking those things, for the arising of these things, will not arise. So to know ourselves well enough to know how to keep ourselves out of trouble, how to have the kind of attention in our mind to watch what's going on, the motivations, the desires, the greeds, the hates, to arise begin to watch their arising and be able to let go of them immediately before they go into some more complicated states, a complicated mental activity. And then there's the cultivation of healthy qualities, helpful qualities of mind. We can tip the balance in that direction. So we don't have to be the victim of circumstances. We don't have to just have to be, our happiness, our well-being doesn't have to be based on the whims of society, of life, what goes on around us. But we can have some agency, some participation in helping move ourselves in directions of greater psychological or spiritual health. We can't always do it very quickly, and it has to be done wisely, And people sometimes have tremendous struggles around this because they expect it to happen quickly, or they don't understand themselves well enough, and so their efforts go up against a wall where they make a lot of effort, but nothing seems to move or change. But this early Buddhist tradition emphasizes that it's possible to learn ourselves well enough, to study ourselves and learn how we function, what goes on, develop the inner knowledge and psychological insights that help us begin tipping the balance towards greater psychological or spiritual health. And so, as some of you probably know, there's been studies made about how people who meditate a lot, some people have been able to shift the basic baseline happiness, the base happiness level that they have, beyond, into extreme levels of happiness. It says that everyone has, they say that most people have this kind of base area of happiness that they're always at. So you have a certain base happiness, and then if something terrible happens to you, you might feel kind of upset for a while, but even if your things are bad, you tend to go back to the base. Or if really wonderful things happen to you, you win the California lottery, you go back to the base. It doesn't really make a big difference. People have this base range they go inside of. But what they're finding is that people who meditate can shift that base range towards greater happiness and greater well-being. That the basic aspects of our personality that influence how happy we are, how free we feel, can shift as we practice. So right effort, making this effort, is based on having this very simple understanding about what are the forces inside of us that lead us to unhappiness, to suffering, and what leads us to happiness. And so we have these two lists. We have the five hindrances, and we have the seven factors of awakening. So being addicted, caught, preoccupied with sensual desire, with aversion, with sloth and torpor, with restlessness and anxiety, and doubt, those forces, when you're preoccupied with them, tend to drag a person down, tend to drag a person, contract a person, create greater suffering. So a very important part of the Buddhist tradition is really understanding well these five hindrances. And this, I can't underscore how important this is, that sometimes when something is unfortunate and painful, we want to get away from it as quickly as we can. And part of the healthy energy, healthy engagement, is investigation, is to understand. Let me look at this. Let me understand how I tend to be aversive. What is aversion like for me? What's going on? Rather than saying, well, I'm not going to look at it because it's painful. I shouldn't know it, or I'm embarrassed by it, or I should get out of it quickly. Let me understand this well. And the paradox, or the irony of this, in a sense, is the very investigation of these unhealthy states is a healthy state. Investigation, one of the seven factors of awakening. So we're strengthening that investigation. As we understand it better, then it becomes easier for us to let go of it, not be under its influence. And as we do that, other qualities become stronger as well. Then mindfulness becomes stronger, energy becomes more available in good ways. The five hindrances hinder energy as well, good energy. And then, with time, when the energy is more involved and engaged, energy, the engagement, is a condition for joy. Now, isn't that great? So in case you were thinking, boy, this energy, Gil's just talking, this is exhausting, just listening to this emphasis on effort and energy and monitoring myself and tipping the balance this way and that. But as we get into it, hopefully, it's been my experience, it becomes a joyful thing. Rather than becoming a burden, rather than becoming exhausting, it's kind of like a self-perpetuating joy machine. It gets kind of fun. It's kind of enjoyable. It's kind of engaging to do all this. And I think it's really helpful for the world to have people who have good, clean energy available to respond and to see and be present for our life as we have it. So, so we have mindfulness, we have investigation, we have energy, dare I say, heroic energy. And then we have joy. And those investigation, energy, and joy are all understood to be energizing factors. As we awaken more investigation, more energy, and more joy, we get more energy. The last three qualities, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity, are said to be tranquilizing factors. And part of the task of mindfulness of energy and effort is to bring in the right balance. And so part of the investigation and mindfulness quality is to be also to monitor the energy we have to make sure it's at the right level. If you're over-energized, over-excited, that's not very helpful for practice. If you're under-energized, that's not very helpful for practice. And so there's a monitoring to find the right balance. And I think for people of practice, there's kind of a trial and error, kind of constant monitoring going on, bringing energy into balance. We're too tired, we're too excited. And so these seven factors of awakening are part of that monitoring or that stabilizing balance is the word people use, balancing of the energy to help us come into the right balance. So, energy. So next time I talk, which now will be in 2 weeks, after Sister Loving Kindness comes next week, we will. I think it's great. Isn't that great to have a name like that? I think it's great. So Sister Metta comes, and then I'll talk about joy. So we have now about 10 minutes, and now it's your turn to, if you have any questions or comments or protests about any of this, this is your chance. Or anything at all you want to bring up. Yes, please, all the way in the back, and if maybe we can get the mic.
I hope this isn't too much off topic, but it seems like an interesting question.
It seems what?
To me, it seems like a very relevant for me and very interesting question. So as I practice, I find that I am able to be more mindful and more present. And in my work, sometimes I come into contact with people who are very unhappy and unpleasant. And I had an experience about 2 weeks ago with a man who was basically yelling at me. Mm. Very, very, sweating and really very, very aggressive. And I was able to listen and be present. And what I found was I thought I was monitoring myself and my own energy and not being too vulnerable to what was going on. And what I found afterwards was that for about a week afterwards, my mind constantly went back to him yelling at me. And I realized I actually absorbed a lot more of his negativity and became very upset with myself that I didn't protect myself better. Mm. And a year ago, I would never have been in this situation because I would have been more protective of myself. But because as I meditate more, I'm just much more open and present.
Right. I can understand this. So I can understand that very well. So there's a lot of responses I could have. So if some of the things I say are not relevant, please don't. Please just let them go. Leave them here. But certainly as we become, with our defenses come down, we can be more open and to the energy around us. And sometimes if we don't have street smarts, the openness and lack of defensiveness is sometimes not so useful. You have to have some sense of how to handle different situations as well if you're going to be open. And so sometimes it takes a while to learn the skills and the understanding to know how to be present in a relaxed way, so that you don't feel like you're victimized by the situation. So it's possible that you were felt somewhat victimized by it. Even though you're open and relaxed, you still have a sense of lack of power, lack of control, lack of choice in the situation. And that sometimes can cause a lingering kind of effect on us. It kind of lingers for a while as a problem. I find it useful in these kinds of situations to ask myself a question. And the background for the question is that when these kinds of things happen, for the most part, I think of them as things coming towards us. And the reason they don't go right through us is that there is something inside of us they strike. In English, we talk about hooks or buttons. There's something inside of us those things strike. Like there's a flag or a post or a banner we're holding up. And so that energy, that anger, comes and hits that banner, that hook, that button. And then it does something for us then. But if you have no hooks and no button, then it goes right through. So an interesting investigation is to then go back and see, what was my hook? What was my banner? What was I holding up? What was I holding on to? What did that strike inside of me? And if you go back and review that, it might be very hard to discern this, but you might, in time, discover that there might be something inside of you that's striking. And there might be a variety of things in different people. There might be some beliefs that, that the world's supposed to be a safe place if I relax. And so striking that belief. It could be that there's old wounds of old trauma that haven't been resolved yet. And there's a clinging or fear or some sense of being a victim or something that's still standing up there, that somehow that is striking. It's like putting salt sometimes in a wound to have that happen. It could be that there's a sense of self-righteousness. It could be a sense of fear. There's a lot of different things. Like I can just kind of go on and on with the list. But to go ahead and investigate and say, what is it just striking inside of me so it just doesn't pass right through? Now, it can be kind of... it's too big of an expectation. It's too big of a, you can't expect that none of us are going to, that we're not going to have any hooks at all. So these things might strike. And then I find it very useful to have some way of dealing with it after the event. So sometimes being able to go sit is very helpful. Sitting sometimes can relax some of the holding and tension that's come up. And sometimes when it's a big event, then something like sitting or some kind of process of discharge, of relaxing, of releasing, can be very, very helpful. And so it's perhaps, and sometimes in doing that, I've seen in myself that that I'm still holding on to something days, weeks, months later around this thing. And in fact, I remember one person who wronged me when I was a teenager. I held on to that for probably a good 20 years. There was still that person, And so I was still holding to something. It took 20 years before I was able to let go of that, that kind of thing. So is there something that still lingers? Because two things I think I'm trying to say here. One is, as you become more open and mindful, anybody needs to develop more street smarts. And part of street smarts, understanding how to work with these situations might involve saying things like, stop. Please, this is not acceptable. I can't just have you yelling at me. Or finding some way of engaging that in a way that you're not just sitting there passively receiving it. Walk away. Ask for help. Go find someone else. Do something. And it takes a lot of wisdom, different situations, to know what the right street smart thing to do is. But to develop that, those skills. Learn wise communication. Learn these communication skills, many things. So that's one thing, learning better street smarts. What I call now today street smarts. And the other thing is to learn better what our triggers are inside of us. And that's a big, big, big task. And it's not something to be, in saying that, I don't say that it's easy. So. It was a very important thing you asked. So how was that answer for you?
That was very good. I do think a lot of it is, for me, is learning more about myself. And the more open I am, the more important it is to know myself. And I had a very similar situation today where this woman was not nearly so violent or upset, and I handled it much better. I mean, it went perfectly. But it was just very interesting to have this situation come up and to believe firmly that I was taking his words of anger and that it really was passing through me, and then to find afterwards that I was dead wrong was
one of the advantages of being open, the word you used, or being mindful or sensitive, being heightened mindfulness, is hopefully we become more quickly aware of when we're uncomfortable, when things, something's uncomfortable here. And rather than saying, oh, you know, I'm supposed to be detached from discomfort, I'm uncomfortable, I'm supposed to kind of handle it and deal with it. And what I think was very important to do is to take discomfort seriously, interpersonal discomfort seriously, and investigate, understand it. What's going on here? So hopefully a person who's mindful becomes more sensitive to discomfort than you were before. And then it's very important not to overlook that or deny it or ignore it, but to take it as very important information, and then to investigate what's going on, what's happening here. So the, and I think with time, a person might become sensitive to discomfort earlier and earlier in the process. So rather than being sensitive, there's something wrong when things have exploded. You become sensitive because you see that the person's eyebrow went up, or you feel a little queasy in your stomach. Oh, I'm feeling a little queasy. I wonder what's going on here. And then you can kind of deal with the situation when it's much milder, and sometimes easier that way. So mindfulness helps us to be uncomfortable, and so we can use that as helpful information. And if you're not mindful, you'll still get uncomfortable, but you won't know it. In Buddhism, we say, it's much better to know if you're uncomfortable, it's much better to know you're uncomfortable than not to know it. So, thank you for your question. So, there was one more. It's not 9 o'clock. If the person, one more person, if they thought there was a quick answer to your question, then I will, you can say it. But if you don't think I'm capable of a quick answer, then... Here.
So if you can just recap that personal joy machine, self-perpetuating joy machine, just one more time. I didn't quite.
The self-perpetuating joy machine. Maybe it's not the right expression, when the energy and engagement is clean, especially with mindfulness, the energy of being mindful, the engagement of mindfulness, when it's clean, unselfconscious, and it comes kind of the interest that arises, and that interest sometimes becomes zestful, energized, joyful, happy, and that joy builds on itself, and that's why I call it self-perpetuating. It's self-building. It builds on itself. A certain kind of inner sense of well-being and happiness. And you see that with a lot of different endeavors. Not such a strange thing that when people get really engaged in something, they kind of lose themselves in it, they say sometimes. It's a very deeply satisfying. So the same thing can happen with meditation or with mindfulness. It's a very deep satisfaction or joy can come from that kind of wholehearted engagement and involvement in it, including with being mindful. So, enjoy your effort. Thank you.